I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Is the Trump campaign about the man or the message? Will Trumpism survive Trump? Our guest this hour wrote a piece that appeared in Politico. It caught our attention. Why Trumpism will outlast Donald Trump. Think he doesn't represent anything besides himself? Well, it turns out a whopping 65% of white Americans say they would consider supporting a nativist third party. Our guest this hour is Professor Justin Guest, an assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University's School of Policy, Government, and International Affairs. He's interested in comparative politics, minority political behavior, and immigration policy. He's the author of The New Minority, White Working Class Politics and Marginality. And he has spent quite a bit of time, 6 months actually, doing field work in post-industrial cities in the British and American Rust Belt, and observed a remarkable sense of loss. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Guest. Our phone number, in case you don't already know it, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And Professor Guest, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Yeah, great to have you here. Tell me first about where you went. What cities did you go to, not just in America, but these Rust Belt cities? What were you looking for and where?
Sure. I conducted three-month-long ethnographies, which just means that I was interviewing a lot of people and interacting with folks and observing day-to-day life in Youngstown, Ohio, which is a puddle jump away from where you guys are, and also in the eastern exurbs of London, England, in a place called Barking and Dagenham.
Mm-hmm. And you found a similar kind of discontent in both places among white kind of working-class people?
Yeah, you know, the United Kingdom and the United States are many people see as cousins, but the more time you spend in these places, you realize just how different they are as societies. And given the differences between us, it is remarkable how similar the sense of disappointment and frustration is being felt between white working class folks and their communities across the pond.
So Donald Trump, we think about him as being a one-of-a-kind. He's here for an election. He's grabbing attention. A lot of people find him entertaining. Networks devote hour after hour of coverage to him. And that after 2016, if he loses, many predict that he will. Who knows? He may win. But if he loses, that's the end of this. This study that you've done, this is incredible to me that 65% would go for a third party, love his message so much, would go with a third party that espoused that message?
Yeah, so first of all, let's just make sure we're very clear on the details here. Because in any kind of research, we've got to make sure we know
sure.
exactly what we're talking about. And this is a sample that is nationally representative inside the United States, but it's only of white Americans.
Right.
And that's, of course, a little bit more than the majority of the country right now. So it's a significant amount of people it's representing. But it is only white folks. And, of course, the vast majority of Donald Trump's base almost is exclusively white in their ethnicity or race. However, yeah, what you said is absolutely correct. You know, what we did is I conducted a survey in which I asked people whether or not they would be interested in considering to support a third party, a nativist third party, and the primary attributes of that party, the primary platforms of that party were American jobs for American people, preserving that, preserving America's Christian heritage, and condemning and removing the influence of Islam. And these ideas, these three core ideas, are actually lifted directly from a third party that exists in the United Kingdom itself. And so the original motivation for this question was to see, well, would there be support for this kind of party in the U.S. were it to emerge? And, yeah, a whopping 65% of our white respondents said, yeah, they would consider that kind of party. And, you know, I think the point here is that November very well may be the end of Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump does not seem like the kind of person who is looking to build a movement. You know, if you look at his history, his legacies, even his statements, Mr. Trump is, first of all, mostly about Mr. Trump. Mm-hmm. He is out there for himself. He's not speaking for a broader social movement in the United States. However, without maybe intending to do so, he may have ignited such a social movement anyway. And that what this survey suggests is that it may be right for someone else to take the baton and move it forward in his absence.
What about the, let's do a comparison with the British UKIP and British National Party, because you have great familiarity with those parties as well. Are they garnering a huge amount of support from white, not incredibly highly educated voters as well?
So the British National Party, which is the party that had that platform that I listed, they are nearly dead, if not dormant, right now. So they are not getting a whole lot of support. Now, they had their heyday in around 2010 and failed to win a parliamentary seat, but won a member of European Parliament seat and won a number of local elections, specifically in the neighborhood where I did all my research in London. So they did have some success a while ago. Since then, UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, has really seized most of their support and really been a more palatable version of the British National Party. The British National Party was viewed as being very militant, revolutionary, violent, intimidating, and using anti-democratic means. Mm-hmm. However, UKIP has much of the same message, but is largely peaceful. And so many of their many former British National Party supporters have moved to UKIP, and a lot of people who previously were turned off by the methods and tactics of the British National Party have moved to UKIP. And with UKIP, we have definitely seen significant success. I mean, this was their first major election in 2015 last year, and they garnered about, I think it was 13% of the British vote, and won one seat in Parliament simply because they have a first-past-the-post system, much like in the United States. It's hard for third parties to win. But then, as an encore in the summer of 2016, just a few months ago, they were the primary advocate for Britain's departure from the European
right.
Union. And their success was viewed as a UKIP success.
Hmm. So you only see them growing.
Absolutely. They are right now working with Jet Fuel. And a lot of this has to do will hinge on their leadership and whether they can endure the scrutiny that this has created, and also how the United Kingdom does with its secession from the EU.
Right. Yeah, which is yet to be seen. Justin, when you say that you, after these 6 months of field work in these post-industrial cities, you observed a remarkable sense of loss. What kind of loss were people experiencing?
I witnessed three kinds of loss, and people that both described it to me in my about 120 formal interviews that I did, but we also were able to collect some of these senses of loss in survey data as well that suggests that they're more broadly important and representative. The three kinds of loss are first an economic sense of loss, and that's a more conventional kind of loss, right, Kathleen? So, mm-hmm. you feel simply less well off than you did 30 years ago. You know, my parents were better off than I was. There are more opportunities back then for me economically. So that's pretty standard. And definitely white working class people have felt that financial sense of loss. Many of the manufacturing jobs that once formed the backbone of the American economy have been lost over the last 40 years as our economy has transformed into one that is more focused on the service sector and high technology. But then less conventional senses of losses are those of social loss. A sense of moving to the periphery in the social hierarchy and the social order of the United States. White working class people used to feel like they were the core, the heart and soul of the American Republic. And these days, many of them feel like outsiders in the country that they once defined. And that is a severe sense of social loss, unlike anything certainly white people have felt in the United States in its history. And then finally, third, there's a sense of political loss. And this kind of loss is one where one is frustrated with the amount of political power that we have, and the feeling that we once had a lot more political power than we do now. And this can be, manifest in the way people think about the care that politicians show for them. How much do politicians care about white working class people today? But also the amount of political power one feels that, you have. So the economic sense of loss, the social sense of loss, and the political sense of loss are really relevant for different people and sometimes coincide.
Were a lot of these people former union members?
Absolutely. So the unions used to dominate the politics of the white working class in the Rust Belt in Wisconsin, of course, as they do as they did in Ohio. And when the unions cease to be as powerful because their membership's dropped and the economy has changed so much, there was left this sense of almost like a political vacuum. Unions were so important to white working class people in the manufacturing world because they were their voice. So even when politicians didn't represent their ideas, the unions could whip politicians into shape and to demand their attention for white working class concerns. And that absence is obviously going to lead to some loss of political power. But Kathleen, you know, less obviously, unions also were a way of organizing white working class people into feeling a sense of group consciousness, a sense of linked fate, something that bonds us together.
Mm-hmm.
And when those organizations that bond us together die, sometimes our sense of identity and togetherness dies too.
Well, let me ask you, because obviously the same thing, the loss of jobs, the loss of unions, happened to African-American as well as white working-class people. Jobs, you know, in this city of Milwaukee, it's one of the reasons we have problems that we've had recently here is big manufacturing companies just left and people lost their good-paying jobs. You don't seem to have the same kind of moving to anything but, actually, the same kind of moving toward a nativist philosophy from African-Americans. They're in the same boat, aren't they?
They absolutely are. And you know, this recognizing that white working class problems are also black working class problems is really the start of a social movement in the United States that simply hasn't happened.
Right.
There is no such thing as white working class problems and black working class problems. There are just problems.
Right.
And unfortunately, it's difficult for both of those groups, along with Latino working class people and Asian working class people, it's hard for these different groups to realize that their problems are actually one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
And the failure to actually recognize this has led to a lot of social and political division that many politicians have exploited. And so, yes, you're absolutely correct. Now, that said, when it comes to African Americans in the United States, it's harder to discuss a sense of loss because the past has been such a difficult past with the legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, and the Civil Rights era. Looking into the history of African Americans in the United States, things could hardly get a whole lot worse, historically speaking. And so in many ways, African Americans can look at what gains they have made socially, economically, and politically over the last 40 years. So even if they have lost their jobs, they may have noticed a greater sense of social centrality in American society and a greater amount of political power.
Mm. In the piece you wrote, you said that these people who are likely to vote for a third-party nativist kind of party are likely to perceive immigrants and other minorities to be ascendant. In short, they are feeling displaced. What are they seeing that makes them believe that immigrants, many of whom are working really tough jobs that not many other people want to do, or other minorities are ascendant? How so?
So when I was in the field, I presented the various people I interviewed with a set of concentric circles. I would just draw them on a notepad with a pen. And I would draw a bunch of concentric circles, kind of like a target sign, like a bullseye.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would do is I would ask my respondents, imagine this set of concentric circles as a model for American society. And imagine that the folks in the bullseye in the middle, they're the folks who are the most central, the most important, the most influential in our society. And then on each ring outward, people are less and less and less important and less central. And I asked folks, tell me where you think you are right now today. And people would make a point with their finger and show me where they are. And then I would say, now imagine people like yourself 30 years ago. Where would you say people like yourself 30 years ago were on these in this set of concentric circles? And then they would place them. And then I would ask folks, well, who do you think is occupying the other rings? Where do you see black people? Where do you see Latinos? Where do you see immigrants in the United States? Where do you see the elderly, women? And people would place them as well. And so I took this same method of understanding people's sense of social hierarchy and centrality into the same survey that I mentioned earlier. And we ask people to do the same exercise using the same kind of set of concentric circles on the internet. And this was an online poll, so it was very easy to do this way. And looking at the data, what we see is that people who feel like they have moved over time further and further to the fringes perceive immigrants to be closer and closer to the center.
Be that the truth or not, that's what they perceive.
Absolutely. And it is the truth for them. You know, this is about perceptions, right? You know, and in politics, perceptions matter more than truth often. And this is the way people feel, even if there's a lot of evidence to the contrary, that immigrants are still having a hard time being upwardly mobile, that we are still creating a lot of draconian laws that securitize and criminalize immigrants. It's not that easy for immigrants these days. But for many white working class people, immigrants appear to be much more upwardly mobile in much better social position than they are right now.
And is that because they're being told that by the Republican nominee for president?
Well, they're definitely being told that by the Republican nominee, and they're being told that by a lot of other politicians who are trying to wield identity politics in order to get votes. And it's all very highly questionable and some would say unethical. To use these kinds of tactics, divide society in order to win. But the truth is, Kathleen, this is one of the oldest tricks in the book, and politicians only need to win one vote more than a half of the electorate. And dividing people is often a very useful way of uniting them on your side.
What's interesting, and you make reference to this, and I think that it's so true, that both Republicans and Democrats have, in many ways, forgotten about this huge group of Americans. They haven't addressed their financial needs, what's going to happen to them after their unions left and their good-paying jobs left. It's just, oh, well, that's just the future. You know, that's just the way things are right now. It's a whole new economy. But wait a second. What about all of these people? How it's as though they've been forsaken by both parties, really.
They really have been forsaken. I mean, that's actually, I'd say, the most accurate description you could have made. You know, white working-class people have tried voting for Democrats. They have tried voting for Republicans. They have tried not voting at all. They've tried protests. None of it seems to work. None of the major parties seem to actually want to embrace the perspectives and the ideas and the causes that white working class people want, or at least not the most fundamental ones. And in other cases, there are sort of more symbolic failures here. A recent book by my colleague from Duke, Nick Carnes, demonstrates that only 2% of members of Congress, both Senate and House, actually have working class roots.
Really?
I mean, that is incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking, you have a government being run by elites. And so there are very few white working class or any working class people who are actually running the government right now. So there's a symbolic problem. Imagine if we said the same thing about Latinos or black people. Imagine if I said only 2% of Congress is black, only 2% of Congress is Latino. Mm-hmm. I mean, people would be up in arms and saying this is wrong. And people do say that this is wrong because they actually are still underrepresented, both of those groups, given the nature of the American electorate. But white working class people represent about 35 to 50% of the American populace, depending on how you measure working class, whether it's by education or income or otherwise. So that's a very large amount of people that don't see their peers in representation.
Let's welcome phone calls. We have a full set of lines going here, and we'll get to you in to more of you as the hour goes on. Justin Guest is our guest. Is the Trump campaign about the man or the message? Will Trumpism survive Trump? Our guest has done a very large study of white working class politics, both here and in Rust Belt areas of England. He is assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University School of Policy, Government, and International Affairs, and is the author of The New Minority, White Working Class Politics and Marginality. 800-486-8655 is the number. We'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two phone calls. Charlie in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was going to ask your guest just that it seems that, in my view, the rise of Trump is due to the fact that people were so disgusted with both parties that they were trying to choose the outsider to do something differently. And a case in point would be they didn't want the social policies being hijacked for doing what's important. Example would be the Zika funding that's being held up by funding for Planned Parenthood. Isn't just the real answer a third party, something like the Libertarian Party, that allows for social liberal thought coupled with fiscal reality the answer? And aren't we seeing that already with the Libertarians? Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call, Charlie.
Charlie, that's a great question, and you're absolutely on the right track, I think. For in many cases, I would say that there are three reasons why people vote for Donald Trump, broadly speaking. The first is that they really do believe in his message, and they believe in what he's saying, and they believe in him. A second group is voting for him just because they can't stand the idea of Hillary Clinton being president. So, you know, it's democracy. You have one choice or the other. Pick your poison. The third group is the group that you're talking about. These are folks who are voting for Trump because he is against the establishment, because he is a revolutionary, because they're so fed up with the system that they basically want to stick up a middle finger to it. And in many cases, that is white working class people, and those are the folks that I've been working on the ground with for such a long time. One gentleman who I interviewed, who is a builder in Youngstown, Ohio, said to me, quote, the thing I like about Donald Trump is that both sides hate him. Unquote. You know, so that he is that third group of people who don't necessarily believe in everything Donald Trump says and don't necessarily hate Hillary. He's just sort of fed up with everybody. And this is him turning the table over on American politics, unconcerned about its effect on his society and the policies that we have and the values that we espouse.
Hmm. Does he think that Donald Trump and that philosophy will ultimately make his life better? And if so, how?
I think at this point, that gentleman, that builder, was so fed up that he didn't think that it could get a whole lot worse. And this is the state of desperation in a lot of white working class communities today. And for that reason, Kathleen, I usually bristle at the idea that white working class people are not rational thinkers and that they're not voting with their interests. White working class people know exactly what they're doing. They have tried other parties. They have tried, other messages. They have tried protesting outside of the institutions of the electorate. None of it's worked. And so they are thinking hard here about their choice. And clearly they think that Donald Trump comes closer to advancing their interests than anyone else does right now. And really it's hard to blame them because Donald Trump is the first major national political candidate in decades who has really sought to transfer word on the street, feelings from white working class households onto the political podium.
Hmm. What about Bernie?
Bernie's a great example of someone who I think really had the opportunity to do the same thing, and in many cases did, except he didn't. He was unable to connect to the social messages that Donald Trump was able to really sell a lot of white working class people on. So Bernie's message was largely economic in nature. And so for that reason, he was able to attract a lot of left-leaning former unionists. Donald Trump, on the other hand, can match some of those ideas from Bernie by talking about trade protectionism and focusing on American jobs for American people. So Donald Trump can compete with that in some ways, at least rhetorically. But he can't. But Bernie couldn't compete with Donald Trump's social ideas. And Donald Trump was really able to capture the moment, the zeitgeist of the feeling that American society was being lost to demographic change.
Let's go to John in Toronto. Hello, John.
Oh, hola, ¿cómo está?
I'm sorry?
No, I am white.
All right.
Only 1/16th Native American. Anyway, let me thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure, John.
I live in a rural area after 20 years in Milwaukee 15 years ago. Working on the jobs, these people are all for Trump. Except for the smart people. No, what I called about is an actual viable third party. I have been saying since I was, 18 years old, how about a national lottery for president? It would be better than what we have now. What I'm saying is, Hillary just has her millions of dollars, and I do not. I felt the burn for Bernie Trump. For Bernie Sanders. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
But, we in America need a viable third party. Seriously, for many years now, without the money, get rid of the Electoral College, number one, and go back to the popular vote.
Thank you, John, for your call. Justin?
John, it's an interesting point. Many people have definitely made the same, so you have a large group of followers behind you, I think. But I think when you're talking about the popular vote, what you're really talking about is a system of proportional representation, much like the European countries that I compare the United States to. So, here's a quick political science 101 lesson when it comes to electoral politics. So some countries in the world are like us, and the U.K. is this way, where they have what's called a first-past-the-post system. You divide up the country into a bunch of districts, and inside of each district, the person who wins the majority of the vote or the highest vote-getter goes to Congress, goes to the parliament. In much of the other parts of the world, and in much of almost the entire European continent outside the U.K., other countries do it differently. They have a broader vote, and there are a lot of variation, but they have a broader vote, and they divide their parliament into proportions as they are elected by the people. So if you have 10 parties and one party gets 35% of the vote, they get 35% of the seats. But that also means that if you have a smaller party that gets 2% of the vote, they get 2% of the seats. And in many ways, that is what is actually stopping the United States from getting a third, fourth, or fifth party. We don't have that kind of system. And so what happens is our institutions advantage a two-party system in the one that you lament right now. Mm-hmm. And so until we do, it's very difficult to have a third party. And that's precisely why the Tea Party never became its own party. And it's precisely why the libertarians from Charlie, the earlier caller, was talking about libertarians. That's precisely why the libertarians have had a hard time, because it's not a strategic vote to vote for a party that's unlikely to win at the district level. Mm-hmm. Were we to open things up, sure, you'd see those parties emerge. And the question is whether Trump has ignited enough of a social movement that it can sustain itself in a two-party world. And one of two things is going to happen. And much of this, John, is up to the Republican Party. Either the Republican Party embraces Trumpism and basically loses much of their mainstream moderates in the process, or they reject Trumpism in the future, and they go back to their mainstream moderates, but risk having a third party developing on their right flank, or worse, perhaps having further insurgency inside of their own party. And that's, of course, what we've been seeing happening with the Tea Party. So it's a great point. Thank you very much.
Yeah. John. Well, what about the Democrats? I'm thinking now about money. I think that John espouses the views of a lot of Americans that you have. If people are sick and tired of all this money, and it's coming from both sides here. You've got Hillary Clinton saying when she left the White House, we're broke, and now her husband's making $18 million for this for-profit university for a few speeches he gives around the world. People are, understandably get a little concerned about that and how the dinner was arranged so he could meet the guy who liked Bill so that he could get this kind of deal. And you've got Donald Trump who's stiffening his workers, the people who are supposed to, he's supposed to pay him for the job that they're doing. And everybody kind of overlooks all of this. It seems to me as though the time is ripe, and I don't know if this is a third party or not, but from what I'm hearing from people is that they want somebody who's honest, who cares about the white workers and the black workers and all the workers who lost a whole lot of money when manufacturing changed in this country and when the recession hit, and they haven't been able to recover. And they want it to be a fair deal for all, some kind of party that doesn't have the anti-immigrant, the anti-Muslim, that kind of, it's their fault that we're so bad. It seems as though the time is ripe for something like that to emerge. Am I really off course here, or do you think that's true? And who would do that? Who would create that kind of party? Would it be a third party, or would it be a new Democratic Party?
Well, I don't think that it'll be a third party. So I guess in that way, maybe you're off, Kathleen. But I think that the rest of what you say is really real. It's actually happening. And much of the appeal of Donald Trump, it comes, or at least it came initially, from his financial independence. One of the selling points that he made for much of 2015 was, I can't be bought. I am not subject to the corporate interests that have bought up all the other politicians from both sides of the aisle over the last, 30 to 40 years as, as campaign finance has gotten so out of control and unaccountable. And he was refreshing in that way for a lot of people. Now, of course, since then, Donald Trump has solicited a lot of money from other people, and his financial independence is actually growing very doubtful because he refuses to actually reveal how much money he's making. But, part of his allure was that financial independence. And so I think that for both he and Bernie, they were able to capitalize on Americans' frustration with the way that people have to buy in just to have your views, represented at the national level. And, other countries around the world laugh at us. I mean, we basically legalize campaign corruption here. It's perfectly allowed. And in other countries, the same thing that we do here would get people and politicians put into prison. So, it is a really crazy system that we have here.
It is.
I do think that there's a lot of demand to change it. One thing I will point you to is that there is a good example that many politicians don't like it either. They spend over half their time on average.
I know, it's crazy.
Raising money.
Yeah.
Who wants to go around begging for money for half of your job? That's not fun. They want to be out there doing the things, representing people in the best of situations. And they want to, conduct research to understand views and meet with their constituents. 50% or more of their time is spent on campaign financing. So, they don't want to do this either. So why don't we all just get this done? Recently, Connecticut did. If you look at the state house, they recently had campaign finance reform, and it was opt-in only. So they didn't impose it on Connecticut state politicians. It was by opt-in. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think something like 60 or 70% of the state's representatives opted in.
Oh, interesting.
They didn't want to do it, and it becomes a campaign selling point. I'm clean of major fundraising and corporate interests. It's a refreshing thing that Connecticut did. Maybe it can spread elsewhere.
Oh, yeah. We'll do a show on that. That sounds very interesting. Thanks for your call, John. Let's go to Jake in Oshkosh. Jake is next. Hi, Jake in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show. Great guest.
Thanks.
In listening to your program, I couldn't help but think about something I read a long time ago. It was an article called Triumph of the Authoritarians. It was written by John Dean. Yes, that John Dean, former counsel for Nixon, who also wrote a book, Conservatives Without Conscience. And basically, his epiphany at the time in 2006 was that he found the American people becoming very authoritarian and enemies of freedom, anti-democratic, anti-equality, highly prejudicial, mean-spirited, power-hungry, Machiavellian, and amoral. And it was just a matter of time before we got our authoritarian conservative. And that's what he foreseen in 2006. And I think with Donald Trump, we are there.
Justin.
And those are just their good qualities.
So we've seen this coming, Justin.
Well, I think that authoritarianism has always been present in American society. We place a lot of pressure, power in presidential authority, and there is an authoritarian aspect to human nature, and it has come, it has emerged and come out in a lot of politics elsewhere with the rise of fascism in Europe. And in the 20th century, for goodness sake, it was relatively recent, along with dictatorships in other countries that used to be democracies in Latin America and elsewhere. I think that there is a strong authoritarian vein here, and Donald Trump appeals to many people who one would think would have authoritarian preferences.
when he gets up on the podium and tells everyone that he is the law and order candidate, that sounds good to a lot of people who have those preferences. And when he tells people that he is their voice, he says that in a singular way, as if there is none other. And that
yes.
kind of megalomaniacal kind of rhetoric is something that we're akin to, that we're used to hearing from authoritarian rulers and dictators. But nevertheless, he clearly is striking a note with many of his supporters, even while he's turning off folks like you, Jake, over in Oshkosh.
Mm-hmm. And Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. A wonderful show once again. I would like to, when you brought up Bernie Sanders, it occurred to me that had Bernie Sanders was addressing these issues exactly, but had he won the nomination, if this was Trump versus Sanders in this round, my guess is every other word out of Donald Trump's mouth would be socialist or Bernie the Red or something like that. So my question is, since we have, socialism is a dirty word in the United States, but what about in the United Kingdom? The angry voters there, do they have, would they be likely to turn to a socialist alternative, someone who would be addressing directly those kind of needs the way Bernie wanted to in this country?
It's a great question, Scott. Yeah, socialism is not only not a bad word in Europe. There are many mainstream parties that are actually called the Socialist Party. And France is a great example. Spain is another example. Labor in Britain would not have any problem with anyone referring to them as socialists. In fact, they selected a socialist as their leader in Jeremy Corbyn. Europe is a very different place when it comes to socialism. But also, socialism has different connotations. You know, in the United States, folks like Ronald Reagan and others have villainized and vilified the idea of socialism as akin to a communist ideology that is anti-democratic. In Europe, socialism refers more to the suite of social programs that provide a safety net to society. So unemployment benefits, food stamps, retirement benefits like Social Security, Medicare. And along with cash assistance and welfare, so public housing. All of these are forms of socializing society in the European sense, and they're forms of socialization that we engage in willingly in the United States. And so, yeah, there's a really big difference in tone. I think your point, Scott, about Bernie versus Trump is also well taken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the polling before the campaign's Bernie's campaign's demise was showing that Bernie was actually faring far better against Hillary Clinton, far better against Donald Trump than was Hillary Clinton. And this is simply because Hillary's unpopular numbers were so, so high. I mean, it's a remarkable irony and twist of fate that the Democrats finally run against someone who is so grossly unpopular in Donald Trump in terms of their unfavorable ratings. And what do? They nominate the candidate who actually can nearly match his unfavorable ratings to make things just that much harder. So Bernie may have had an easier go against Donald Trump simply because he didn't have the unfavorable ratings and people may have seen him as a safer pick. But ultimately, it's really unclear how that would have worked in a national campaign because Bernie was so far left of the American center, it's unclear where moderates would have gone.
Hmm. What's going to happen if Trumpism does survive, if he loses the election and the movement survives? What happens to moderate Republicans, all the people who, you know, run the House and the Senate right now?
Well, this is the scariest set of circumstances and the big question that Reince Priebus and Paul Ryan are thinking about right now and have been for the last 12 months. What are we going to do with our party, they're thinking to themselves.
Right.
And that puts them in the position, as I said, they're either going to pander to the Trumpist far right, and they're going to try to welcome them into the tent and somehow hold on to as many moderates as they can, but inevitably they're going to lose a lot of that mainstream center-right block, and they're going to likely flee to the Democrats, who are going to probably make more appeals to them. Because that's what the smart party will do. If your opponent is moving farther to the right, you can capture more of the right too while maintaining your far left flank because they don't have another option. On the other hand, if the Republicans reject Trumpists, as we're calling them, then the Republicans are either going to have an even more fiery insurgency inside of their tent, or there could be the emergence of this third party or a lot of third party candidates at the district level, which means that they'll likely lose a lot of general elections to the Democrats.
Mm. More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our lines are busy right now, but just keep the number in that head. Our guest is Professor Justin Guest. He is an assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University School of Policy, Government, and International Affairs, and we're talking about Donald Trump. More importantly, we're looking at the people who are inspired by him. We're looking at white working class, not highly educated voters who are his base, and really the Republican Party's base as well. Interestingly, our guest has spent a lot of time in the field in post-industrial cities in this country and in England looking at the sense of loss that many of these people are feeling. He is the author of The New Minority, White Working Class Politics and Marginality. Scott, thanks as always for your call, and we'll take more phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bernie Justin in Elkhorn sends this message. What's needed is to make third-party and independent candidates viable is instant runoff voting, that and opening up the presidential debates. What do you think, Justin?
Well, you know, the presidential debate is really, you know, the manifestation of electoral politics. It's not, I don't think the presidential debate, which, you know, only happens a few times every 4 years, is really going to be the deal maker or the deal breaker for third parties. So I guess I disagree with Bernie. I think, Bernie, that, you know, what we really want to see happen, if you're looking for a third party, is for institutional change. And, you know, we simply can't – no rational voter is going to vote for a third party who they know has absolutely no chance of being represented. If you had proportionate representation, as you do in other countries that I mentioned, then you could know that, oh, even if I lose, I'm still going to gain a share of the representation with other people like me. But, Bernie, before we kind of praise proportionate representation as the sort of panacea here, a lot of dangers await proportionate representation that we see in other European countries. Proportionate representation is often a recipe for the influence of really far fringe parties, radical groups who are dragging politics to the fringes of society. And it's precisely for this reason that the far right, the radical right, who are in many ways akin to the British National Party and also possibly Donald Trump, have done so well in countries like Austria, Switzerland, Denmark, and France. These are countries that have had proportional representation in place for a very long time, and these once fringe parties have grown in support because they've been fueled by the rational choice of voters to vote for them given those institutions. In Israel, for instance, it is precisely proportionate representation that gives voice to the what I think are very radical ideas of settler communities who are driving Israeli politics further and further to the right. Because they are in coalitions with mainstream parties. And they basically hold the mainstream parties hostage and say, well, look, if you want to form a majority, you have to bring some of these fringe parties in under your tent. And then they can, and once they're inside the tent, they can make demands or threaten to leave the coalition. So in many ways, you know, our system in the United States is frustrating to those of us who want to see third parties emerge. On the other hand, it can, in many ways, it's also less risky because you just don't know what kind of parties will emerge and whether they'll drive American politics off the road.
Hmm. Mike in Franklin is next. Hi.
Hi. I just like to disagree with your guest on one issue. When Donald Trump came forward, it wasn't refreshing. He was given $2 billion of free airtime. I don't care what channel you turned on the TV station, there was Donald Trump. But the thing that's most disappointing to me, if he gets elected, okay, he already said who he's going to appoint to the Supreme Court. The for us to try to throw out Citizens United or that, it's just going to get worse. There's going to be more money in politics, not less, because Donald Trump, all he cares about is himself, and he's going to make sure that the people he puts in there just care about the wealthy people in this country. It's going to be worse for us Americans if Donald Trump gets to appoint Supreme Court judges. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Justin?
Hey, it's a fair point. I mean, the point about airtime is really important, and here's why I'll push back. If Donald Trump wasn't refreshing, he wouldn't be on TV. TV, radio, you know, folks in the media are smart. They know that they want to keep listeners listening. And if something's not refreshing, no one wants to listen to it if it sounds like old hat. Donald Trump has managed to find a way of staying relevant all these months of the presidential election and constantly finding reasons for people to actually watch him and listen to him, drawing some of the biggest audiences on non-sports television in history for his debates, for example. So Donald Trump is definitely engaging people, even if it's, you know, out of, you know, mania or fear, people are still watching him. And you're absolutely right that he has benefited enormously from the airtime. And, yes, that's likely a preview of what a Donald Trump presidency will look like. Me, me, me. What can I do to keep the camera lens, to keep the attention on me? He is definitely one of the most self-aggrandizing candidates any of us has ever seen.
Maya in Burlington, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on your show,
sure.
Kathleen.
Sure.
I'm hoping that you have. I just tuned in a little while ago, but I don't know if you've addressed Evan McMullen, the newly declared independent candidate, who I support. I could not have voted for either Trump or Clinton. I was considering voting for Johnson, and then I went and saw him speak last week in Milwaukee at Serb Hall, and his platform doesn't speak to me.
And McMullen's does because?
Definitely. Well, he's conservative fiscally. He has a good grasp of foreign policy. He was boots on the ground, CIA, working in the Middle East for 10 years. And then he's, when it comes to the social issues, he's a little moderate, and I really appreciate that. He has said gay marriage should stand. Let's just move on. I agree with that 100%. I feel like he really has some answers that we need right now.
Justin, we haven't heard a whole lot. We heard about him the day of his announcement, but not much since.
No, and the reason why, Maya, is that, you know, folks who are in your position, you know, it takes a lot of courage to vote for a third party, but it also takes a lot of, you know, comfort with risk, in the sense that risk that your vote may not actually count a whole lot. You know, and this is, again, going back to the institutions of American politics. This is the way the system is structured. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense if you're voting strategically and you want your vote to count, to vote for someone who is highly unlikely to come anywhere near a majority in each district or state that's being counted. And so while I appreciate, you know, the idealism and the very clear attention that Maya has taken to select her candidate,
and I
wish all American voters would take that kind of meticulous, you know, detail orientation to their politics, it may be lost on the American political system.
Hmm. Yeah, Maya, you've really gone to town finding the candidate that you wanted. That's good for you. How many of us do that? That's a good thing.
Well, there are a lot of us, and specifically I feel, and I understand strategic voting, but I feel like in this time of my life, I'm going to vote my conscience. And if it means that my vote didn't matter, then if enough of us have voted our conscience and somebody pays attention, you know, right now, it started with Better for America. They worked on gaining ballot access. And then they turned when he announced, they closed up and many of their staff went and worked for him. So now he's on ballots, I think, in 9 states. Several state parties, independent parties, have given him their ballot access. In Wisconsin, we will be able to write him in, and his name will be counted. And so it's just a matter of, you know, getting enough people to understand. And sure, will he win outright? Probably not at this point. But the hope, I guess, is that nobody does, and then we see what happens. And that's, you know what, maybe that's where we are right now as a society. You know, time to sort of remove all those old ideas of how it should be and see how it could be.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. That is part of what's going on. Maya, thank you so much for calling in. Well, Justin, that about does it for us. You're a really good guest. I hope you'll come back sometime.
Absolutely, anytime.
You will?
Yeah, anytime you guys like. You have great listeners, too. I was very impressed. And it's nice that Maya called, because I was beginning to think that all your listeners were men.
White men. I know. I was thinking the same thing. That happens sometimes. It's just the, you know, sometimes it's all women who call. It was just the luck of the draw this hour. It's because you've been talking to a lot of white men. That's why.
Well, no, it's no coincidence that your final guest, your final female guest there was by far, I think, the most discretionary about who she selected as a political candidate. And I certainly wish all of your listeners a lot of luck.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. We'll talk to you again, I hope, before the election. Justin Guest, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University School of Policy, Government, and International Affairs. And he is the author of The New Minority, White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour and finding this interesting guest. We'll have him back. And thanks for your calls and for listening, everybody. We're with you again tomorrow at 2, Why We Stop Teaching American Political History in Our Classrooms.